gavel for a work session. It makes me feel weird, though, to not do that. So it's Monday, November 10th, 9 a.m., 2025, and we are here to talk about
tax, TIFs, among other things, assume. So, DeCarlin, I'm going to kick it over to you.
Thank you, ma'am. So as we start looking at how can we work on redevelopment of some of our commercial areas or just development period, one of the tools that we can utilize is TIF, tax incremental finance. And so what I want to do is have a presentation from members from PGAV. So I have Andy and Susie here. And I'm sorry, I don't want to butcher your last name, so I'll let you introduce yourselves. But they're going to kind of give a rundown of what TIF is, how it operates, how it works, and then what a potential TIF could look like on our business district and on the downtown, not the downtown, but the loop business, CID.
Okay.
So great. I'll kind of let the PGAV take it over.
Can I ask PGAV, what is that?
What does it stand for?
Yeah.
So PGAV stands for Peckham, Guyton, Albers, and Veatz.
Okay.
The four guys that founded the company.
I'm sorry?
The four people who founded the company.
Okay.
It's just names.
And this is a company that does
They're a planning development firm, right. And so they kind of look at communities and kind of help you develop your development district plans.
I'm fairly certain their first slide is introducing who they are.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
And I didn't want to butcher their last name, so I just said PGAV. So.
Okay, thank you.
Here we go. Thank you for the introduction. We'll just go ahead and jump right into it. My name is Andy Struckoff. I'm the president of PGAV Planners. A little bit more about PGAV and who we are. We are a consulting firm. We work in economic development, urban planning, and development finance consulting. We were founded in 1965 in St. Louis, Missouri. We have offices in St. Louis, Kansas City, and Orlando, Florida. Our practice spans the country. We're active in 35 states. Our destinations practice is active across five continents. And a little bit more about the company broadly. PGAV Planners is one part of PGAV. There's also PGAV Architects, which is a general services architecture firm. They do a lot of work with the University of Missouri, for example, the University of Kansas system as well, a lot of university work that they do across the Midwest. PGAV Destinations, we master plan and design theme parks and aquariums and tourism destinations across the planet. But Susie and I were here to talk to you this morning about tax increment financing. I wanted to make a joke about welcome to our TIF talk, but here we are this morning to talk about TIF, what that means, how to do it, what's the process, and what could it look like in Columbia. So we'll start just sort of giving an overview about TIF with some of the fundamentals about TIF, what it is, how it works, why it exists, et cetera. And if, as I'm talking, if you have any questions, please interrupt and ask away. I'd like this to be a conversational thing as much as possible. So the concept of tax increment financing is it creates a public-private partnership tool that is an incentive to overcome development challenges. It enables an area to fund its own revitalization by using incremental or new taxes to pay for certain eligible project costs. And what that means is, as new taxes are created within a defined redevelopment area, those new taxes can be reallocated to pay for certain project costs. And that's up to 100% of incremental property taxes and up to 50% of incremental sales taxes, with some conditions and nuances about the property taxes that may be allocated, reallocated. And then there's a concept which we refer to as a super TIF. Projects that are anticipated to bring in net new tax revenues to the state of Missouri may qualify for reallocation of incremental state revenues. That's what we call a super TIF. So some of the terminology we're going to talk through here, a redevelopment plan is the document that's prepared that describes what the community's plan is for a defined redevelopment area. A redevelopment area is the geography within which tax increment financing may be approved. Redevelopment project is the project, or could be multiple projects within that redevelopment area, that is going to generate the new tax revenues. Payments in lieu of taxes, it's the statutory term for the incremental property taxes that are reallocated. Economic activity taxes, these are the sales taxes, utility taxes, earnings taxes that are generated by economic activity within a redevelopment area that may be reallocated to TIF. And where does that money go? It goes into a special allocation fund that is created and managed by the city. We'll walk through these in a little bit more detail. This slide will just kind of walk through what pilots are and how they're calculated. So once, if a redevelopment plan is drafted and adopted by the city, establishing a redevelopment area, within that redevelopment area, that geography, that property value is set as the base property value. So say, for example, you've got an assessed value of $1,000 with a tax rate of 5%. Of course, these are not real numbers. It's just for hypothetical math, just for an example. That generates $50 in tax revenue. Then you have some development that increases the property value to $100,000. That same tax rate, you generate $5,000 in total revenue. So go ahead to the next slide. So on the base, the taxing districts get $50. Then after development and after the approval of TIF, the same $50 goes to the taxing jurisdictions. But then the increment, that $4,950, goes to the TIF. A similar concept for the incremental economic activity taxes. So you have $1,000 of sales taxes, utility taxes being generated within an area, and then after development you have $100,000 in sales taxes being generated. Yeah, as TIF goes on, the base amount of $1,000 is distributed to the taxing districts. And then during TIF, the taxing districts get that same base amount plus 50% of the incremental growth in economic activity taxes. And then the other 50% that isn't captured by the taxing districts goes into the special allocation fund for use in funding the redevelopment project. Any questions about any of this so far? Okay. So this chart here shows what happens over time. The TIF Act in the state of Missouri limits the life of a TIF redevelopment area to 23 years. So you can't have a TIF district or you can't approve TIF tax increment financing for longer than 23 years. The operating theory is that once the TIF expires, once the redevelopment has taken place and the TIF goes away, that increase in tax revenue goes to the taxing districts 100%. And that's what this graph shows. You know, during the TIF, the purple section of money goes to the special allocation fund and the blue section of money goes to the taxing districts during and after the TIF. So what is the TIF process? At the beginning, there's a TIF commission that is established. The TIF commission is an advisory body to the city council, much like a planning commission. Their job is to assemble and hold a public hearing about a TIF project and redevelopment plan and redevelopment area designation. During the public hearing, the public may comment, and the TIF commission really can set its own process for that. Like they have some statutory requirements they need to follow about noticing time frames and the time from noticing to holding the public hearing. But if they wanted to hold multiple public hearings, they could. They can kind of manage that process as best they see fit. And their job is to hear about the redevelopment plan and the redevelopment area. The redevelopment plan is required to contain certain findings. A couple of the important ones are whether the area qualifies as a blighted area or a conservation area. Okay, and these are statutorily defined terms. The blighted area definition asks, does the area predominantly suffer from deterioration, lack of investment, and sanitary unsafe conditions? Does it challenge housing development? Does it present a danger to the public health, safety, and welfare? Does it challenge the city's economic independence? Does it present a social liability? These are all the questions that blighted area definition asks the city and their consultants to answer. And if the answer to those questions is predominantly yes, then the TIF Commission will be presented with that information and that evidence to support a determination that the area qualifies as a blighted area. Conservation area is another qualification test and definition in the Missouri TIF Act that has a few more factors in it. Really, the idea behind a conservation area is saying that while the area may not yet be blighted, it's on its way because the buildings may be old. That's one of the findings requires that more than 50% of the buildings are 35 years of age or older, that there's disinvestment, that there's deterioration, that there's obsolete land uses, and things like this. So, and there's certain tests in that conservation area definition, like you'd need to find a minimum of three of the factors of deterioration, obsolete land uses, you know, inadequate utilities and things like this to support a finding that the area is a conservation area. And so the TIF Commission is presented and the city is presented with this information and the redevelopment plan to make a determination whether the area qualifies under either definition. The other test is the but-for test, which is sort of, we put that in quotes because it's sort of a phrase that's thrown around a lot. It is, you know, the but-for test is a thing in the TIF Act that asks, you know, if TIF didn't exist, would you reasonably expect an area to be subject to development by private enterprise? Okay. And that's a question that the city would need to answer about a redevelopment area on the whole, right? Predominantly, would it be subject to development by private enterprise? Is it a reasonable expectation? And there needs to be some documentation attesting to a determination whether or not the predominance of the area would reasonably be expected to be subject to development by private enterprise in the redevelopment plan. The redevelopment plan needs to conform with the comprehensive plan for the community. Like the land uses it prescribes, the type of development it prescribes, need to be in conformance with the comprehensive plan. Some communities use TIF as a tool to implement their comprehensive plans when they're done. And a redevelopment project must be approved within 10 years of redevelopment area designation or TIF approval. I mentioned earlier that the life of a TIF is 23 years, and that clock starts once a redevelopment project is approved and tax and grid financing is approved for that redevelopment project. But that clock can start within 10 years of an ordinance approving a redevelopment plan. Right, so those are two different steps that the city has to take once they have recommendation from the TIF Commission, whose job is to either make a positive recommendation about TIF approval or a negative recommendation about TIF approval. Another item that is required is the cost-benefit analysis, which the TIF Act defines as the fiscal impact analysis on all affected taxing jurisdictions showing the impact whether the project is built with TIF or not built. So what it does is it lays out all the math for all the overlapping taxing jurisdictions. You know, here's the taxes they would get based on existing conditions and no development. And then here are all the taxes they are estimated to receive based on development with the tax increment financing project in place, so that everyone can see what their impact is expected to be during the life of a TIF redevelopment area. And then, excuse me, following all this documentation is a redevelopment agreement or redevelopment agreements. And these are agreements between the city and a developer or developers outlining the roles and obligations of both parties and the conditions for developing a property and using tax increment financing. And that's a legal document that's really gets going once the TIF is approved. An example of how TIF has been used in the state of Missouri, I'll talk through this one. This is the Cortex Innovation District in the city of St. Louis. It's a 200-acre hub of business, innovation, and technology. And it's really in integrated into a couple different neighborhoods in the city of St. Louis. And the operating theory behind the establishment of the Cortex District and the TIF was to create or incentivize development between WashU Med School on the west and the campus of St. Louis University on the east. Recognizing at the time before this TIF district was established, this area was blighted and suffered from disinvestment. And so the way this district was born, several stakeholders in the city got together, created a nonprofit organization called the St. Louis Innovation District, which goes by the name Cortex, and sort of set them up as master developer of this area. And then started this TIF in 2013. Okay, and this 200-acre area includes 11 different redevelopment project areas. So it's not just one whole TIF district. The TIF district itself was kind of carved up into smaller areas so that the developers and the city and Cortex have a lot of flexibility about how they incentivize projects and how they have incentivized projects across the past 12 years. By setting it up this way, they have the ability to use TIF to incentivize a particular project and also leverage that incentive to pay for public improvements across the entirety of the district. So for example, there are a couple new office buildings in Cortex. In the city of St. Louis, there are few healthy office markets. Cortex is one of them. So they could leverage the energy they've created to attract office development and then use that office development to pay for public needs like a parking garage, public plazas, streetscapes, and things like this, which has really helped Cortex build out the neighborhood. And they're still in the process of building things. There are a couple multifamily projects sort of in the pipeline for this district. We've been working with Cortex over the past 10 years, helping them sort of plan development and plan for the use of TIF and also monitor the incremental revenues that are generated within the district. Any questions about any of this so far? Okay. So talking about, as DeCarlin mentioned, you know, TIF in Columbia, TIF in the business loop. Talking with DeCarlin and talking with the folks at the Loop Community Improvement District about this idea of using tax credit financing to fund some revitalization and development along this corridor. This map you see in front of you is a map that largely follows the boundaries of the CID. I think there are some variations. It's just a draft for conversation purposes at this point. So the idea would be, or the thought would be, to use tax credit financing to attract development to the area and use that development to fund public improvements in the area. Just sort of speaking hypothetically at this point, all of this is subject to testing with the Loop CID and with the community, but really setting up a TIF district that, the goal of which would be to help the community facilitate its own revitalization.
Andy, can I ask, on the map that you have here that's showing the potential proposed TIF, obviously I see that the city-owned power plant, Moores Lake, is not included in that, and I can't really tell if, like, Mizzou North is included, because this is a very very far away from this bird's eye view, but I'm just wondering, with a TIF district, you know, private land versus publicly owned land, what is the common practice in that? And is it even possible, since we don't pay
mm-hmm. right? Taxes on this, so I'm assuming we would be included. But if any of them become revenue generating, like if it's public land, but something's happening on it, the revenue, the sales tax conversation, I'm just wondering.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So sometimes public land may be included in a TIF, and we've seen it included in TIFs in the past for various reasons. Sometimes land, sorry, in some cases we've seen land owned by a public entity, like a land bank or something, within a TIF, and the idea being the TIF is going to help get this property out of the land bank and into productive use. We've also seen public parks included in a TIF district, the idea being that some TIF revenue may be set aside for improvements in the park. So while the park itself may not generate any incremental revenues, it could benefit from the TIF revenues being available to pay for some improvements that the community would like to see in the park or in the area around the park. So it's really up to the city and the community how they would like to see that property involved.
And based on what you showed earlier, if they are not included in the boundary of that, they would then not be eligible for any of those improvement dollars if they weren't part of the redevelopment plan?
Generally, yes, that is true. There are some nuances, though, to that rule. If certain property may be on the edges of the TIF area, but if, say, for example, the redevelopment of the TIF area necessitates the creation of a new signalized interchange or a new pedestrian facility or an expansion of a roadway leading to the redevelopment area, then you could make a legal argument that TIF revenues should be made available to pay for that improvement outside the TIF district because the development within the TIF district causes that need, right? So there are some nuances there, but generally, yes, if you have a property outside the TIF district, you can't extend a benefit of the TIF district to it without some clear connection.
Yeah, Nick.
You may get to this in the presentation. If so, I apologize, but I noted that or took note that it has to conform to the comprehensive plan. So what would be some other considerations about the types of projects that could be used for in addition to use of the comprehensive plan?
The comprehensive plan is kind of one planning document, one planning idea. The city could also adopt a specific plan for an area, like a neighborhood plan. If it's a plan that the city adopts as a plan of the community, even though it may be like an appendix or an amendment to the comprehensive plan, it could still, the TIF plan could still follow that document. But what you really need the redevelopment plan to do is it really needs to represent the community's desires for development within a specific area. So you need to have some adopted plan framework of the city that the redevelopment plan itself can reference.
And does the legislation require, or does general practice or best practice describe the manner in which that is done?
The statute, like the Missouri TIF Act, doesn't prescribe how that is done. It really only stipulates that the redevelopment plan must conform with the community's plan for this area. That could be a comprehensive plan or a neighborhood plan. How that plan comes into existence or is adopted and approved by the city is up to the city in each case. So it would be up to you all about how that process is completed.
So this is something that would eventually, I would assume there would be community input of various kinds and then ultimately a decision be made by the city council then?
Yes.
Are you talking about for the TIF plan or for our comp plan?
Okay. For the TIF plan, yeah.
Yes, and I think that, you know, given how active the Loop CID is and has been, and you've got a group of engaged business owners and property owners there, that, you know, they would certainly be involved in the creation of this TIF and informing, you know, what the TIF could be used for, what the plan, informing the plan itself would require some engagement with them and with other property owners in the area, for sure. Yeah.
How were the boundaries of this TIF chosen? How did we come up with this map that very closely follows Business Loop, but then also includes this little section to the side?
City staff worked with the Business Loop, the CID, to determine it, but really it came from DeCarlo and I talking about where the areas were. When you drive that corridor, you can kind of see where the needs are present, and that's how the boundary was determined.
But the area being developed as the Opportunity Campus? Yeah.
It is, I believe.
Ish.
Yes, I think that area is included. Yes, I believe so. It's just the power plant was excluded.
Yeah, it looks like that's part of determining where this boundary lies.
And this was drawn before that construction started. I think the project was known. It just hadn't started construction yet.
Thanks.
This also includes some residential areas, I think, doesn't it?
It does. There's a few fingers on the north side where there's some residential. Some of it looks like it may have been excluded. You can see that one inset, the long keyway on the far left. But yes, there are some pockets of residential along that corridor. And those parcels, some are being maintained as residential structures, but I think a lot of them are some semi-commercial use right now.
So there isn't any plan to redevelop these residential uses into commercial?
I think that's undetermined.
That's undetermined? Because yeah.
This is really just concept. This is just very, very high-level talk.
Okay.
Yeah, if there's homeowners that want to stay in the area and want to be part of the redevelopment opportunity, I think that's 100% can happen. If there's folks that are – those are investment properties and they'd like to change that, that's certainly, you know, part of the possibility.
And a lot of this was drawn at looking at what potentially could be. And so there's not a plan to say, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to convert residential into commercial. But when you look at what's happening in that area, a lot of that residential has started being converted over to more of an industrial use, not necessarily being held as housing.
Is it? Sorry.
And then Valerie had her hand up too, but. I couldn't see who was first, but I saw the hand up. Sorry.
You go for it, Valerie. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be changes in land use? Wouldn't that be directed by the comprehensive plan and not necessarily by this?
Correct.
What does our comprehensive plan say about those areas?
I have not looked at that in detail. Okay. I'm just looked at a very cursory review of it.
At this stage in the conversation, at this stage in the process, are we looking at this being the final boundary, or would this be open to conversation as we have those public hearings?
Yeah, this is all conceptual.
Okay.
And so I think if we start going down this path of looking at a potential Business Loop TIF, then those more in-depth conversation about what should be and what should not be included will happen.
Fabulous. I'm looking at like one block that I would love to add in.
Again, okay. It's just a concept. It was an idea. We
of
wanted
course.
To have a kickoff point for a conversation.
Yeah, Betsy.
What other TIFs do we already have in the city?
So right now, the Broadway Hotel, I think they're on their final stages of their TIF. They've just sent in their plan for their payment requests for their section 2 for the new tower that's just been built. I believe that's the final TIF that's still out there. Nancy, help me out.
Was it Tiger Hotel?
Tiger Hills.
The reports are due this week, so we should be getting.
Okay. But at the moment we think that it's the two hotels.
Yes.
We don't have any other major districts like this?
Not major TIF districts. I mean, there's a couple of commercial districts or CIDs and a few TDDs, but I think the...
Okay.
Yep, those are the only two you've done. And Broadway has two TIFs.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Broadway 1, the Broadway 2, and then the Tiger.
Yeah, Valerie.
Very general question. Can you tell us a little bit about CIDs, TDDs, and TIFs?
I shall.
Sure. Happy to.
Please.
I don't have any slides on these, but I can talk about them. So CID is a community improvement district. Okay, it has its own statute, and the revised statutes of the state of Missouri. What a community improvement district is typically is a separate political subdivision established through a petition process. Petition must be signed by more than 50% of the property owners per capita, meaning individually, and according to assessed value, meaning who owns most of the property, most of the property value. And then once that petition is submitted to the city holds a public hearing. The city council holds a public hearing to hear the CID petition, give the members of the public an opportunity to come and talk and ask questions. And then the city approves it via an ordinance or doesn't approve it. And then it's up to the city whether the CID exists or not. Once established, the Community Improvement District, which is governed by a board, which may be stipulated, defined, or appointed via the petition, or the city itself may appoint members to the CID board, or a mix of both can happen. The CID can impose a sales tax of up to 1%. It could also impose a property tax at a specific dollar amount per $100 of assessed valuation, or a specific special assessment on property value, on property. And that special assessment can be, there's a lot of flexibility there in what that is. It's just a defined dollar amount that the property owners in the district have to pay. The petition itself lays out what the plan is for the CID, why it needs to exist, and how the CID is going to spend the money it raises via any or a combination of those mechanisms. The CID is limited to a life of 27 years. And I'm trying to think of what else. We do see community improvement districts and TIFs paired a lot. Communities and developers have kind of paired those two tools together to generate revenue to pay for, either a larger development project or more public improvements or a mix of both. Any questions about CIDs?
What's the strategy for pairing a TIF with the CID, and how does that affect the taxes that are collected?
Sure. So the strategy is trying to come up think of a good example. Chesterfield, Missouri has a TIF that's been approved, and after some consultation with the state auditor's office has been reapproved. That includes, it's a large TIF area. The reason the TIF exists is for the city to implement its comprehensive plan, which stipulated the redevelopment of Chesterfield Mall into like a downtown for Chesterfield, Missouri, which is a suburban community that doesn't really have a town center at this point in time. That TIF district is overlaid with a community improvement district as well. That community improvement district will help the TIF fund certain public infrastructure needs, because they'll need to build a lot of roadways that don't exist now and interchanges that don't exist. And in that TIF process, the city really drove it. The city kind of brought the property owners to the table, the owners of the mall and the owners of some development near the mall, and said, hey guys, the city wants to do this TIF because we need more infrastructure around this area and we want this to be a downtown for the future of our community, and got the ball rolling that way. But that's one example. Generally, why these two tools are paired a lot, and this pairing often also includes transportation development districts, which I'll talk about more in a minute, to create more revenue to help pay for infrastructure improvements or whatever the project needs are. The CID itself, once it's created, half of those revenues can be captured by the TIF, so it helps the TIF generate more revenue. But how that happens, that happens automatically unless the CID and the city and the developers reach another agreement about how to treat those community improvement district revenues. Transportation development districts. It's another statute in the state of Missouri, the TED Act. It's also created via petition, and then created via a court order after a public hearing, assuming the petition is right and proper being signed by, you know, the qualified owner, qualified voters within the proposed transportation development district, which means property owners, majority of the property owners signing the petition. The transportation development district can impose a sales tax of up to 1%, can also approve a property tax. I think the maximum property tax levy is like 10 cents per $100 of assessed valuation. You could also do special assessments. Key difference between a TDD and a CID, the TDD has very limited applicability. The TDD revenues can only be used for transportation infrastructure, meaning roadways, interchanges, parking garages, and all of those improvements need to be owned by the TDD as long as the TDD money is paying for those improvements, either directly on an annual basis or through repaying a financing that was issued to pay for these improvements. So you often also see TDDs layered with a CID and a TIF to pay for things like parking garages and roads and interchanges. And we see that a lot these days, largely because paying for parking garages is really, really expensive.
Betsy, you had a question?
Yeah, I have a couple now. The TDD, is there any oversight to that? And is there a length? And does that also stop at 23 years or whatever?
Yeah, so the TDD can be in place for 40 years, okay. which is much longer than the other two mechanisms. The oversight, so both the TDD and the CID, those are both overseen by boards that appointed. The city can appoint board members. The city may also just appoint a person to sit in on all the board meetings and be aware of what the TDD and the CID are doing and how they're spending their money. Both entities are required to report annually to the state of Missouri about their activities and how they're spending their money. So there's some oversight there. But they are also their own jurisdictions. And so while the city maintains situational awareness and some level of oversight, really the CIDs and the TEDs can spend their money how they like and how they represent it to the city. They would spend their money at the beginning when they were created. But it can also be how those entities spend their money. If these things are layered on top of each other, like there's a TIF and a CID and a TDD, and then there are redevelopment agreements memorializing how these monies are spent in furtherance of the achievement of the city's goals, and if all these things are subject to redevelopment agreements memorializing how all these relationships are supposed to perform and how these monies are supposed to be spent and what everyone's rights and obligations are, then that's really where the city has some teeth in how those monies get spent, is in that redevelopment agreement. Outside of that, the city doesn't really have any annual say in how the money gets spent unless they have members on the board.
Okay, and then if we did this with the business loop, we already have a CID there, so this would be that layering on top of it.
Right, okay. And since the CID there has been in place for so long and has a lot of history, I think it would be necessary to talk with them about that relationship between the TIF and the CID and how these revenue streams work together.
Thank you.
Yeah, Vera.
I know that with this particular section that we are looking at, a lot of the concerns that we hear and are very aware of in the community are accessibility, our pedestrian, our sidewalks, our road crossings. Would that fall under a TDD, or does TDD focus more on vehicle transportation?
Yeah, that would fall under a TDD, yes.
And just to really quick, and I don't know if Nancy or finance, somebody else might know, we have a number of TDDs in Columbia already.
Correct.
And we'll see every once in a while that annual report come across. Or I don't know, but Nancy, do you know off the top of your head how many we have?
16. We have 16 TDDs. We have three CIDs, actually. There is the North 763 CID as well.
Okay. And then, TIFF is the only one. It's Broadway 1 and 2.
Right.
Okay.
I don't ever remember seeing any TDDs. I'd see the CID reports come through.
We'll see it's usually when they're board members, when there's a change happening. So like the St. Charles one, I think of, is the one I see the most frequently that has. And then there's the one north on Range Line that we'll see come across.
Yeah. And then you've got several of them associated with properties like Grindstone Plaza, Discovery Park.
Mall.
There's St. Charles Road. Columbia Mall. The Shops at Broadway.
Rhinestone.
Yeah, and they don't necessarily send us an in, as far as you, because they don't have, they're not required to,
Correct.
And then I guess maybe less of a question and more of a comment. I think it's so interesting that you use the Cortex as an example. Like three career trajectories ago, I worked there at their first office building that they set up in the area. And I think the way they have it structured, particularly with that nonprofit that put it together in the first place, which we have Columbia residents on the board of that nonprofit, by the way, that we can reach out to. They do a lot beyond what you particularly think of with a CID, where they do a ton of workforce development. They do a ton of innovation and conferences and bringing things in. And I think they would be a very interesting model to look at, to look towards. So,
yeah, Jackie.
So if we're looking at, if we get to the point of the discussion where we're looking at the development of a commission.
We have a TIFF commission.
We have one.
Right.
Okay, so can we just clarify that? Like,
yeah. So we have a TIFF commission.
Do people need to be appointed for this specific project?
That's the question. So we have a TIFF commission. So your first part of that pull, so I assume that it would start with that group?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so nobody additional needs to be added.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so
but
just, to clarify.
Subject to whatever she says.
Right, so the city has its permanent members of the TIFF Commission who are the city-appointed representatives. If there is a project and a specific project that comes through, then the other taxing jurisdictions make appointments to help consider that project. So it's kind of a two-step project.
Yeah, so we have
two-tiered.
Yeah, so we have seven on it, I think is what I'm counting. And then there's two Boone County appointees, one affected districts appointee, which I assume would be then the person representing if this was along the business loop, the loop CID, mm-hmm. and then two school district appointees.
And so a lot of times
we would
those
not
don't
make
get
those
appointed.
Appointees. Right.
We don't reach out to those and get their appointments unless there is a project coming through. So I refer to those as kind of having our permanent members and then the others come in.
If I could ask just a, this may be getting too far in the weeds. Does the university still have that North Mizzou campus there, or did they sell that property?
Still their property.
So are they represented on the TIFF commission, or would they be included since they are included in this boundary?
They're not one of the ones listed.
Okay.
Nick, did you have a question?
Well, going back to a previous slide, you mentioned a super TIFF, which is kind of catchy, so it caught my eye. Does that make a, is that applicable here? How is that defined?
Sure. So the way that is defined is it requires some analysis and working with the State Department of Economic Development to make a determination that a project within the area is going to attract a lot of tourism, a lot of visitors from outside the state of Missouri, or a lot of, it's going to bring economic activity into the state of Missouri on a net new basis. So that super TIFF has been used. I'm trying to think, the most recent example would be in Osage Beach, the Lake of the Ozarks, for that large Lakeport project.
So this one really is looking for a larger impact
it is.
Than in a particular area. Yeah. regional or statewide.
Right. Regional or tourism or a new industry that doesn't yet exist in the state of Missouri, something like that.
Okay, gotcha.
This is your last slide, right?
Yes.
Okay, so us asking all of our questions now is the right time to do it. Okay. So at a conference recently, I was listening to the mayor from Lincoln, Nebraska talk about they have a rental rehabilitation project that's in a TIF district that they did. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I was just wondering, you know, the types of projects we could see, yes, commercial, right, and improvements to that, but then also some of these kind of like multifamily affordable housing projects. Do you have any other examples of ones like that? And then my second question is going to be for staff on, when I look at these other cities, they have both the statute that's required by law, by the state for what they can do, and then they almost have like additional policy or clarifications that help with that but for and that help for that. And so I just didn't know if, I couldn't remember if we had a policy on that. They get specific to talk about like in treating for affordable housing or those who are benefiting. So first question to you on examples for like housing affordability projects and then to staff.
Okay. Good question. I'm not familiar with the Lincoln, Nebraska example, but I'm familiar with that concept being applied in other communities using tax increment financing. Quincy, Illinois, for example, has a downtown TIF district where they use incremental revenues to create a grant or revolve. It's really a grant program for property owners to fix up, you know, second floor residential properties in their downtown Quincy or other for rent residential properties. As a way to, you know, increase housing accessibility in Quincy. I've seen other communities use 353, use tax abatement to also, 353 is another mechanism where you can abate property taxes, which then reduces the cost basis of housing, which can make housing more affordable. in Florissant, Missouri, years ago, they used a TIF to create a revolving loan fund to help pay for housing improvements and housing development. The neat thing about using TIF revenues to create a revolving loan fund is you know, you can define that as your project in your TIF, right? You say one of our projects is we're going to create more residential development, and the revolving loan fund could be a mechanism through which you achieve that goal. And then the revolving loan fund, once it exists, even if it's seeded with TIF revenue, that money comes back as a revolving loan fund money, and you can just sort of keep it going. So you can use TIF to sort of juice, so to speak, speaking very colloquially here, but to seed a revolving loan fund. Down in Memphis, Tennessee, we worked on establishing their community redevelopment agency, which oversees a large TIF that covers uptown Memphis, which is a neighborhood north of downtown Memphis, just north of where St. Jude is. And the large TIF district included Harbortown development, which is large-scale residential development, what used to be called Mud Island, is now called Harbortown. And the goal there was to take the incremental revenues generated by the Harbortown development and create money to fund housing development in Uptown. Uptown is a neighborhood, if you know the movie The Blind Side about Michael Oher, that's the neighborhood he grew up in, you know, in that movie. And so the TIF revenue from Harbortown pays for grant programs, it pays for, you know, for existing homeowners to fix up their houses. It also makes money available for low-cost financing for developers in that neighborhood to build new housing. So there's all different kinds of ways you could structure a TIF and use it to create housing opportunities.
Yeah, yeah, and I think the example in Lincoln, I know it sounds a lot like what you talked about in Quincy. They referred to it then as braiding the financing because similar to us, they have what sounds like it's in Quincy, renewable, they have energy efficiency loans that like their utility gives, and so it just helped do that redevelopment and improve those housing examples. Don, do you want to ask for that before I have staff answer my question about our policy? Yeah.
Question on those, you mentioned the different programs you mentioned that are funded by the TIF. Do those then end when the TIF expires?
Well, so with the revolving loan fund, it can continue. So in Ferguson, we had one around Emerson Electric, and so once the TIF ended, those funds were still being utilized to do redevelopment in that neighborhood around the Emerson Electric campus. Okay. And so
the revolving.
It can't survive the end of the TIF.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's like what jump starts it.
Correct.
Yeah. So question to staff then on sort of our policy of what we have.
So I think we adopted the normal but-for policy that the state calls for. It didn't get into the where you were looking at for housing and for that assistance. So it's just the normal part of it.
Okay.
But it's something we could look at and we could talk about, especially project specific. When we know here's a project that we're looking for, and here's the things we're trying to target within that project.
Yeah, like what sort of improvements we want to see, our outcomes expected. And I'll just note, which we just started to do on this, this is just an example of a potential of a map.
Correct.
And from you know, experience in following these, like, this is where we're going to get stuck. And so I think I'd probably encourage for those best practices for like what sort of outcomes do we want to see before we start getting into the, well, hold on, let's go into this street, right? Because we want to see improvements, and this is an area, this is just an example of one area in Columbia that we want to see improvements in. So like, what do we envision it could look like?
And we started the conversations with the business loop first.
Yeah.
Before we started saying, okay, let's bring something for the council to talk about. We wanted to make sure that we had at least some type of agreement of this makes sense. This is something we should start having more and more conversations about.
And my assumption is that like our current project that we're working on with that DOT grant, where we're looking at the infrastructure improvements, that will help guide part of this.
Absolutely. Because when you start looking at what's it going to cost in order to make the improvements along the business loop, especially
for sidewalks,
not just the transportation part, but also for some of the stormwater improvements, those are expensive lifts. We're talking about burying utility lines. Those are all things that are going to cost a lot. And so this TIF process allows you to raise that revenue to do those type of things that can enhance these projects.
Can I ask, though, so I just said not to get into the weeds on it, but can I ask why we did exclude the power plant? Because I know we have some infrastructure on it, but it's also a potential really cool space.
It is. And I think the one thing that you could do with TIFs, if we ever get to the point where we believe that we would decommission it as a use for a power use facility, then we can have that conversation. Remember, the power plant, because it's paid for with utility dollars, it's a lot more nuanced to trying to do some type of development on it.
But Moores Lake is beautiful now.
Moores Lake is gorgeous.
People would want to hang out on it. Okay.
Well, and under your charter, you cannot dispose of your utility property or use it for something other than utility purposes, long-term lease. Now, I'm also going to throw out real quick, I emailed the City Council just now a copy of the Gilmore and Bell summary of economic development tools that they just updated for 2025. It will give you a really good update. Everything that Andy talked about with regard to TDDs and CIDs will be in there. You know, you've got the information on the TIF here. It also covers TIF. It covers the 353. You don't have to get into all the weeds that they get into with the exact process and the votes, but the important part about that is it gives you the list and the overview of all the various economic development tools that are available. And if you just read at least the summary and the types of uses and things that it can be used for, I think it will be really helpful to carry on this conversation going forward about how those can layer with each other for specific uses.
I was just going to ask next steps on this conversation. You know, you're bringing this forward to us. You have obviously been in conversations. What are your envisioned next steps?
Also, for the business loop, I think it's having more conversations with the loop to see exactly where we're at. And is it the timing right to start bringing something forward as for that conversation? But what we do know is there's going to be additional developments that have been talked about in our community that's going to cost for this type of tool. And so just having that understanding of what this could look like is important. I mean, we know the university is looking at doing a request for
information
around their campus to look at an entertainment district. So the tools that will be needed in order to do that are the tools that we're talking about.
What I think for that would be really useful for council to know those rules about what can actually happen on publicly owned land.
Yes.
Versus privately owned land,
And I know a lot of times what you'll look at is once that publicly owned land becomes more commercialized, so where it's starting to generate what could be considered a sales tax or could be considered a property tax, it allows you to use your pilots or your EATS in order to start collecting that incremental revenue.
So I think the question I would have for that is that those are also areas of land that are not paying property taxes that go to our basic general fund that funds safety and road improvements, and yet would still be expected for a response. And so I would want to know those examples in other communities. How then are, you know, if we're seeing additional mm-hmm. increase in people and activity, how do I make sure I still have then the revenues that I need to make sure I can fund for safety? Yeah. So I guess I'd be in, I don't know if you have examples off the top of your head.
I do.
Or
yeah.
Oh, you do? Okay,
I do.
Magically. Yeah, let's go, magically. Andy.
That's what I'm here for. Actually, it's interesting as you bring that up, DeCarly, because thinking about TIF and universities doing private development or public-private partnerships on their campuses. Recently worked with the state of Kansas on a project on University of Kansas's campus in Lawrence, where they have, state of Kansas has TIF. They also have a mechanism called STAR, which stands for sales tax and revenue. They also have community improvement districts, which function pretty much the same way I described they do in Missouri. They've layered a TIF and a STAR district and a CID on almost all of KU's campus and some area outside the campus. The goal is to help the university finance improvements to their football stadium, a new hotel, conference center, and new student housing. So it's definitely a thing that's happened, and I'm sure University of Missouri folks have paid attention to that project and how they've structured that one. Because in addition to using, you know, fundraising to help pay for it and bank financing, they're also using this public finance mechanism to pay for that project.
So in that example, again, that's the University of Kansas. I assume they also are not paying property taxes.
Correct.
Or any of those. So then how does that then offset then the increase in demand? You know, are there some then taxes somehow or pilot?
So there are sales taxes generated by the football stadium and the development to come next to the football stadium. Those revenues are captured. The TIF district also captures some commercial development off the main campus. So it would capture incremental property taxes on the development off campus. It would capture the incremental sales taxes on campus and everything off campus across this entire geography. And then the CID would capture sales tax revenue across mostly the same geography.
But then those revenues are then going to the district. I guess this is my question, is like, is the city missing out then on what it is they need to provide those additional calls for service that are going to be created by this? And how is that, do they do a different type of relationship then on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I have to reach out. I don't know the answer to that question. But we could call Craig Owens, who's the city manager in Lawrence, and get an answer to that question.
And the one part, so when we look at TIF, especially for sales tax, remember we capture 50% of the incremental revenue would go to the TIF district, but then 50% would come back to the taxing body, and so we would still capture part of that incremental revenue.
Is it enough, though?
That's the question.
Yeah. Because we're not seeing an increase in a lot of revenues that go to our general fund. So I think it's an important question to ask.
And I think that's one of those part of the analysis that you do when you look at what makes sense for, you know, these type of redevelopment tools.
Yeah.
You know, you look at what are those economic impacts and what are the potential revenues that can be generated that can kind of help you see exactly, if you pull on a TIF bond, you want to know how do you pay for that. But also, what are some of the things that are come back to the city or some of our other taxing bodies? And so this allows you to have that look.
And that third, I think it was your third kind of step in it, they do a cost-benefit analysis. And would that be part of that conversation? Would that go into the analysis, do you think? Or could it?
Yes, I think it would, because I think part of that, the cost-benefit analysis helps you understand how much revenue the project can generate. Part of that conversation around developing that document is, you know, what services does the city need to provide as a result of the project, and is the city getting enough revenue from the TIF project to pay for those services? The answer to that question is yes or no. If the answer to that question is no, well, then it becomes a conversation around, okay, how do we dispose of these revenues? How can the city make sure that they get enough money that they need to provide services within the deal structure, within the structure of the public-private partnership. So you have those conversations once you sort of understand the universe of dollars that may be available and the universe of needs created by the project.
Yeah.
We do see that often, that once you get to that step, you understand, oh, the fire district is going to need a couple new fire trucks to pay for this project. Or the school district is going to have a bunch more kids they're going to have to educate, so they need money out of the TIF as well. And once you understand what those needs are, then you say, okay, we need to figure out a way to do a capital contribution from the TIF for this amount of money to the fire district or to the school district. One other nuance in the TIF Act actually is that the fire district can sort of exempt themselves from TIF. They have the ability in the statute to ask for reimbursement each year from the TIF, so they can participate or not, it's up to them.
But that's not eligible really within our city limits, because that's with unincorporated Boone County.
Correct.
Is in the fire district, yeah. Because we have our own separate fire department. So
okay.
Yeah.
Correct. Thank you.
Okay.
I should say that's only if they're their own separate thing. If it's a city department, then it doesn't. Okay. Right. So you have those conversations as you get into it. Yeah.
Yeah, Nick.
Well, I welcome this conversation, and I'm really interested in TIFs, particularly when it comes to housing development. We saw some of this, those of us who were able to go to Madison, Wisconsin a couple of years ago and seeing it very successfully used there. But considering that the past is prologue, I'm wondering how our history with TIFs would impact us moving forward with yet another one, and what that process has looked at, what the barriers have been, what the fallout may have been about that and the public perception.
That's the reason why we're bringing forth for this conversation right now.
You go, you're welcome.
Because that's the idea. We really want people to understand what this tool is and how it can be utilized and take away some of the myths of what it means or what it could mean. I think, you know, in the past when the city tried to do a very large TIF, it combined a lot of residential property within that TIF. And that's not what we're looking at. We're really looking at trying to concentrate on the commercialized part. While there is some residential that's adjacent to it, it's really trying to make sure that we're looking at what can happen in that business area itself and not necessarily how does it affect the residential neighborhoods or taking in someone else's property.
Well, that's really what I have in mind. And I think that we moving forward, we would have to definitely want to speak to that in an ongoing
Absolutely.
Manner and be able to show what the actual impacts of this would be in the product.
Yes.
That has to be very well defined, and it's one of the reasons I ask about its comportment with the comprehensive plan mm-hmm. and any other input that there might be.
And remember with our comp plan, I mean, that's a plan that we're subject to try to start the process of trying to
exactly
have,
right.
have a relook at so we can update it to kind of fit to our newer modern standards.
Right. Yeah, and as we're going to go back and look at the comprehensive plan again, develop that again, I think it's good to keep this kind of thing in mind as
Absolutely.
As an instrument that can be used to carry that plan out.
Absolutely. And so when you look at, so I know the question of like with Madison and looking at how do you do some of this residential components of it, it really has to have that. I look at, you know, you look at down range line, there's opportunities where you can have a transportation district that actually has some of that residential part that you can utilize a TIF in order to help you do the commercial development, but also some of the residential that will support that.
And you're speaking my language.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Any other questions for Pete, Andy, or Susie? Carlene, what do you need?
This is information. I just wanted to start having this conversation because we know that in the near future, as we're looking at redevelopment opportunities, this is a tool that we may want to utilize. And so I just want to make sure we have some familiarity with it.
Yeah. So I think from what I heard, it'd probably be useful to also, similar to what Nancy just shared with us, which apparently has some of the questions that we had, kind of like the difference between the different types of economic development tools that are out there. And then maybe some of those examples, especially ones with other university towns, that we can see. And for those, maybe also seeing what are included in their additional sort of guidance, not just the statute from the policy, but
yep.
what additional things did they then put into that so that we can think about for ours.
Absolutely.
Anything else on this topic? All right. Anything else that anyone wants to ask questions? Well, we have our work session happening right now.
About anything. This is anything you want to talk about. Jackie wants to talk about anything. All right. Well, thank you for your presentation. You don't have to keep sitting there if you don't want to, but you can.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So just, yeah, we don't have anything else listed on our agenda except for like any other items that council wishes to discuss. So yeah, Jackie, question.
Yes. So my question / suggestion, I'm aware of some city persons and also community members who've been meeting to discuss downtown safety issues. And so my request, because I feel that involves all of council, is that those perhaps become public meetings and all council is included on those meetings moving forward. Can that happen?
You want to see about organizing an upcoming, I mean, we have a meeting with the university and the county and others in December. So whether or not we want to have that be kind of just like invite all of council, but then it becomes obviously a public meeting have a separate one about conversations about what we're doing.
I think a separate one would probably make more sense. And so, yeah, we can sit down and have a conversation about what's going on and what we're doing or what we're not doing to kind of get in front of a lot of the narrative that's out there. So we can do that we can schedule a work session to have that conversation.
Schedule it sooner
than
later.
A work session prior to the, I think it's a December 4th meeting.
I'm not sure of the date, so I'll have to go back and check.
A bunch are going to NLC, so we might miss out on some with that and Thanksgiving. But try to schedule soon. That is the question? Yeah, Betsy.
Do you want to do it as a pre-council discussion, or would you rather do it as a separate?
I would like to have a discussion, and if there are discussions happening with groups of people in the community that are organized, that are in directly regarding and trying to address community safety, I think that should be a council discussion, not just a selected few.
I guess my question is, I don't know that it's a good thing to do as a pre-council. I'm not sure who's involved in all those meetings. I guess I'm just asking that to make sure that people can show up. I mean, our pre-council meetings have a tendency to be pre-council meetings, but you know, if it needs to include the university, or it needs to include downtown business leaders, or it needs, I don't know who's involved in all these meetings.
Well, and it really depends on what the conversation is. So I mean, there's conversations with the downtown district where they have questions or they have concerns. They want to know what we're doing, what we're not doing. So having those conversations about this is what it looks like and this is what we're doing is a one conversation. I think there's conversations that we've had with the university where we've been called in and said, okay, what does this look like? What's going on? What's being worked on? And it's those conversations. So I think from an optic standpoint, the opportunity for us just to sit down as a group to say, okay, here's what it is and here's what it isn't. And that could be done at, I agree, I think trying to do it as a pre-council, we may not have enough timing for it because, you know, depending on what those questions are, it can get to the point where, okay, now we're rushing to get into the next meeting. And so having something like this where we have more opportunity to have a more in-depth conversation could help.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity for the city to help organize a collaborative effort. Instead of the multiple conversations that are happening. And I just want to, it is my perspective that that's what we should be doing in this situation.
I'm wondering if there's a reason for the preference to have a separate meeting rather than, or potentially rather than in addition to opening up the meeting with the other stakeholders.
Because I can't speak for the other stakeholders right now. And so I can't say that we can have, because I don't know how the other stakeholders will feel about having this open meeting. I know what we can do as a city and what that would look like for us.
Would it be possible to ask the other stakeholders if they would be open to making that meeting open?
Absolutely.
Perfect.
But just talking right now, I know what we can structure here.
Yeah. You can't read their minds.
Correct.
Val.
I think it would be very helpful for us to, regardless of how this open meeting goes, to bring back the agenda items and meeting minutes from the university meetings, from our December 4th meeting, and talk about the action items that have been discussed that are facing the city specifically. I think it's important for the whole of council to have a discussion on these items.
And whether or not that's a separate work session or even just a report on a council where we have the conversation on a regular council meeting in addition to having a group meeting work session.
Certainly. And I think that, that the form of that depends on what the other participants respond when we ask if we can open the meeting.
Well, I think the important thing for us is the having the conversations that are germane to the city, and whether or not the other entities want to participate in it, I think it's us talking about what we're doing and what we're not doing, and so having those conversations is important. And so, yeah, we can do that.
Yeah, Betsy and then Nick.
I guess I'd suggest we do it whether it's morning or afternoon, but not as a pre-council meeting.
Yep.
And I would suggest that it includes the CID, our police department, the city, and an invitation to the university to join us. Mm-hmm. Those are the four I think of. Are there more that you guys can think of?
I would say probably the chamber has some conversations about this as well. So it's
okay. Those five.
Yeah, Nick.
I would just want to be sure that we know what our goal is for and the purpose of this meeting. I don't want to be reactive, particularly to the actions of an individual actor in the community. And I think we know what the issues are. I think we're addressing them. So if we want to have another conversation about that, fine. I just would like for us to clearly define what the goal of this conversation would be, or the goals would be, and what would be the end result.
My assumption is part of it is you know, the narrative has been taken away from us. And the city and police department, fire department, and the city manager's office has been doing a lot of proactive work for improvements and increasing, especially related to downtown safety. And so it's an opportunity. I see it as an outcome, is an opportunity to continue to share that story of what we know is being done.
And in the meantime, we can continue to share that story. I don't want to wait for a meeting.
Yeah. No.
I mean, we have things that are being misrepresented in the public. They've consistently been misrepresented in the public, and we need to speak back to that to clarify what the truth is.
And I think to that point, that's something that Jackie has raised before, where council really needs city staff's help mm-hmm. in being proactive with putting that information out there and consistently putting out the myths that we might be seeing, because we are part-time and don't know all the information. So for those who have that information, to be correcting the narrative is useful for us.
Right.
Yeah, Val.
Yeah, I think this is about more than storytelling and narratives. I do not think that this is directly reactive. I certainly think that there are reactive actions that are in process. I also think that there are narratives that we are not seeing because we have not taken the time as a council to look at the full discussion and the action items that are coming to us. And so we are not seeing them until they hit our agendas. I think that it's best for us to get ahead of that so that we understand the context around what is coming to us.
And I think part of what's occurred is that these conversations that we're having, they've started in the last year. Now, when we did our community survey and we came back and people said, here's the things that we feel are the most important things that we feel like the city's not addressing. Now, they talked about safety in parks. They talked about safety downtown. They talked about, you know, what are we doing for our unsheltered population? What does that look like? And so the work that's being done had started from those conversations. And so I think there's just a feel that everything is kind of reactionary to now, as opposed to things that we've been talking about for the last year of how do we put things in place to make sure we're addressing the things that people have talked about that they're concerned about in our community.
To that end, we have like at least two new council members since that December work session and then the follow-up staff work session. Yes. It might be useful to kind of remind, I mean, you're running, so you know you're probably paying attention to the time, but maybe for all of us to have that, because especially since we're doing a community survey right now.
Yes.
Similar questions to what we asked last year, how are we doing? It'd be good to have us see that what was submitted last year, especially helping us acknowledge what has been done
right
over the last year in response to those priorities that the community set in the survey.
Absolutely. And that's something that staff has been talking about, trying to put that together. So, yes.
All right. Anything else? Any other issues, comments to bring up? All right. Well, I appreciate this. Appreciate you, Andy and Susie. Thank you for helping us with Economic Development Tools 101 and what we can do in Columbia to help improve. So, DeCarlin, thank you. And I'll go ahead and adjourn our work session at 10:15. Thanks.